This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
. 2020 is set to be the year of virtual or digital banking here in Malaysia, with programs like the E-Tunai Rakyat proving a huge success, with over 3 million signups in the first few days of it being launched, and more push towards Industry 4.0. This will accelerate the need for more innovative business model to serve the underserved and unserved market segments. Virtual banking is here to stay, and with me today to talk about the who, the what, the why, the when, and the how is Shankar Kanibaran, the Financial Services Advisory Partner for EY. Shankar, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it.
So I guess we got to start with the who. Who are these digital banks, the microcosm of a digital bank?
Right. If we look at the digital bank, typically, the name that people would be familiar with in this part of the world would be the likes of Kakao Bank. But if you look at markets such as in UK, then Atom Bank, Starling Bank, Monzo, N26 would be some of the names that you'll be familiar with. So if we look at the typical digital bank or virtual bank, what you call that across around the world, typically there's three categories that we see them. One is they are investor-backed or investor-led digital banks, which are typically private PEs or VCs that's funding them. So these are the banks that are launching virtual bank, going after certain segments of the market and trying to acquire customers from that. The second category that we're seeing are the non-incumbent banks that are launching virtual bank. So example would be Kakao Bank in Korea, KakaoTalk, which used to be a talk app largely in Korea. They control about 90% of the market. They launched a Kakao Bank, which has gone after customer segments within that market as well. The third category would be banks who are launching a virtual bank themselves. So Goldman Sachs, for example, launched Marcus. You had UOB in this region launching Tomorrow. NAB in Australia, for example, launched UBank as well. So there's broadly three categories of virtual banks that we see in the market today.
Why is this happening? Why are these brands who are previously not involved in the financial services are now trying to get into banking?
Okay, so essentially the players are seeing there are a micro segment that are today unserved or underserved by the traditional banks in itself. So they're looking at, how could you go after this market by providing better customer experience, better rates, better services, and also targeting that. And I think part of the reason is because the growth in terms of Industry 4.0, like you mentioned, with the fintech and so on, have brought new players into the market that's going after segments or value chain that traditionally has been kind of ignored by the traditional incumbent players as well. So that's why we're seeing a lot of these players are coming in. And I think touching around the point about why virtual bank or digital bank are proliferating in this part of the world and so to say in UK as well, is simply because, a lot of questions. Earlier we had a chat about, I have an internet banking account. Isn't that a digital bank as well? So I think there's a fundamental difference when we look at a virtual bank versus a bank with a digital channel as well. Virtual banks will have a different business model in terms of how they look to serve their customers. Essentially, what it means is that they are only typically mobile-only channel, so they only serve without any physical presence such as the traditional bank compared to the traditional bank as well. And when you look at the business model, typically they tend to digitize from front to back in terms of the operations itself. Less interaction, less manual processes, a lot more straight to digitized process as well. And customer services, for example, they tend to leverage a lot on technology, chatbot technologies, for example, to serve their customers rather than having call centers or human interacting with the customers. And if you look at the segments as well, they tend to offer products and services targeting a specific micro segments, for example, gig workers, millennials, and so on. So that their business model is slightly different than the traditional incumbent banks, where traditional incumbent banks tend to serve a broad variety of customer segments, tend to have much richer product and services, whereas the virtual banks tend to have a very niche products and services targeting specific micro segments.
And these traditional banks can't serve this current group of new breed of the gig workers and stuff?
They could. Nothing's stopping them. But I guess that's where the challenge lies in terms of who can better serve the markets, right? So traditional incumbent banks, traditionally, I mean, if you look at that credit processing and so on, would require a certain amount of documentation and everything, because today, that's what the regulation, the process that they have, and that's how they would need in order to assess credit, assess particular potential customers. Whereas what Virtual Bank has done is using alternative data and alternate credit modeling are able to better assess as well as reach out to this underserved or unserved segments better compared to the traditional banks.
But this has to be facilitated by Bank Negara Malaysia, obviously, right? So where are we at this point of time? We've seen, I guess, examples that you've mentioned in Singapore and then, of course, in the UK and Korea as well and in Hong Kong. What about Malaysia?
So Malaysia, what has happened is that Bank Negara has issued the draft exposure just right after Christmas, and they've given basically the industry about 2 months up to 28 February to come back with comments in terms of the virtual digital bank license. They have publicly stated in the exposure draft that there's going to be 5 licenses given out, and they've given some criteria in terms of would be interested parties who would bid for that. We expect then probably by end of Q2, then Bank Negara would open up the licensing application process. And by end of Q4, we should have the five winners of the licensing. And by 2021, mid or towards Q3 2021, we should start seeing one or two of the new virtual bank licensing coming out in the country as well.
So you mentioned that the Bank Negara Malaysia has already sort of given out like an application criteria. What exactly are these criteria? How do they actually differ from just applying for a traditional bank?
No, they don't differ. I mean, at the end of the day, if you look at a draft exposure, they have clearly stated that, look, whatever in the FSA and IFSA still maintain the same as well. But what they are looking for essentially from the would-be interested participants would be, one is your ability to demonstrate that you're going to serve the underserved and unserved market, how you're going to bring innovation to the overall Malaysian financial services sector. Third is how you're going to maintain the risk and compliance and regulatory framework that's there today. So essentially, they're still putting a conditions around that. But where we see some leeways in a sense that, not leeways, I would say some reduced restriction around, for example, regulatory and compliance. As you're aware, regulatory and compliance in the banking industry is quite a highly regulated environment with high standard and requirements for you to comply with. But what they've done is they've given a bit of leeway for the virtual banks or digital banks in Malaysia should be awarded in a more simplified manner, where there are some regulatory and compliance where they would be measuring them on a slightly simplified method compared to the traditional banks as well. So essentially, you give a bit more leeway. But having said that, what they have done is they have said that, look, during the first 3 to 5 years is a foundational period where your total asset cannot exceed 2 billion ringgit. So they're trying to say that, look, while your capital requirement is 100 million for the first 3 to 5 years going up to 300 million, I'm going to restrict you in terms of the total assets that you could go after as well. So they're trying to balance between how do you bring innovation into the market? How do you get new entrants, non-incumbent and incumbent players to go after the underserved and unserved market, but yet making sure that overall financial stability of the market is not impacted as well.
But the crucial underlying element for virtual banks is also on the KYC part. Has that changed then?
So they have issued a guideline around eKYC, likelihood. A lot of the virtual bank in the market, such as Korea and Hong Kong, we looked at, I mean, definitely the business model will precipitate around using eKYC as a method. So they have issued updated guidelines on eKYC. In fact, if you look at that, the money exchange and remittance player have been using eKYC as a beginning start, and we expect this to continue to the virtual bank as well.
Because I think a lot of Malaysians would probably be very familiar, especially in this first quarter of Malaysia, with the E29 rebate that's been given, 30 ringgit into your touch and go boost and grab wallet, right? Yep. And that has seen some success, and this I guess will spur the demand then for, I guess, people to understand and have that trust, because trust will be a big challenge here for these virtual banks then.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, traditionally, you're used to your incumbent banks where, I mean, the strength that incumbent bank have today is the brand name, right? The recognition that you feel safe, that your cash will be in the bank. Tomorrow you wake up, the money will still be there. And whatever transactions you do, you're assured that, you know, the integrity of the transaction is there. So then you're going to see once virtual bank comes into picture, I mean, if you take that UK market, for example, they have today close to about 30-plus virtual banks that are going after different segments, micro SME, SME, retail, and within retail, different segments as well, right? So the challenge they have is how do you build a brand name that people would be comfortable into depositing their cash into the bank and also conducting transactions and so on. So where we see, in terms of looking at potential interested party that's going to apply for the digital bank license would be, you know, around five elements. One is where you're going to find your capital, who are the shareholders going to be, and given the requirements from Bank Negara about who can be the shareholders of the virtual bank, somebody with good reputation, somebody who knows the industry and so on, then question is who's going to be the capital partner, who's going to pump in the capital. Second is where are you going to get your customers, because the biggest cost in terms of virtual bank would be customer acquisition, and hence who would be able to bring the customers into your virtual bank, because the beginning years would be, you know, how fast can you acquire customers and how fast could you monetize or convert that customer base into profitable customer base, right? The third element would be around product development. A lot of people can do innovation in open market, but in a regulated environment such as banking and financial services, the ability for you to innovate is within the framework of the regulated environment. So question is, how can you innovate and come up with products that comply with the existing regulation but yet attract new customers to come on board, right? Fourth is about the risk and compliance. Ultimately, you are still in an environment that's going to be regulated by Bank Negara. You need to know what are the risks and compliance associated to that as well. Fifth would be around the element of brand. So would you, as a customer, how would you attract, for example, XYZ, today you've heard, I mean, in it's open public news in Singapore, Grab, for example, has applied for the banking license as well. So question is, as a member of public, would you bank with Grab Bank, for example? What would it take for you to build that brand name and trust for you to bank, you know, buying services from the Grab is one element of that, but putting your cash, hard-earned cash into Grab Bank and be, you know, able to trust them is also another question. So question for that kind of consortium would be, how do you build that brand name to be able to make sure that you give that assurance to your customers as well?
Yeah, because security is a huge factor. Absolutely. When you're going in the digital space. Absolutely. I mean, no company is, you know, can avoid when it comes to, I guess, you know, hacking or criminal activities, right? Yeah. Are they in some ways then protected or insured by, you know, the governing policy or the, you know, the banking regulation? Because, you know, losing 10 ringgit is painful for anyone, more so for these virtual banks who are serving the underserved and the unserved market.
Yep. No, I think they would be governed as what the exposures draft said, that, I mean, they will be governed under the FSA, IFSA Act, and also part of it is the PIDM. Today, all your accounts are protected under PIDM. I believe the virtual bank license would also come under the MBIT, similar MBIT as well.
I'm speaking to Shankar Kanibaran, the Financial Services Advisory Partner for EY, and we'll continue in just a moment. BFM 89.9.
Begin fun moments. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
And we're back. My name is Jeff Sandhu, and with me today in the studio is Shankar Kanibaran, the Financial Services Advisory Partner for EY. And we're talking about the who, the what, the why, the when, and the how of virtual banks as we inch closer to the realities of them arriving here in our shores. Shankar, since this would bring new players into the banking sector, is this still only for a select few startups because of just how capital intensive it is?
Absolutely. I think, I mean, if you look purely from a licensing requirement, 100 million to 300 million ringgit, I mean, while comparing to the traditional banking license, local domestic license requirement, 2 billion, foreign owned, 300 million. So, I mean, you can say that, okay, capital is fairly decent. I mean, I think fairly attractive enough. But then the cost to stand up a operation of a digital bank from a technology perspective, from operations, from risk and compliance perspective. Then the question is for the non-traditional bank players would be that, you know, I guess the question at the board level would be that, look, if I'm going to spend, you know, 250 to 300 million to stand up a bank, let alone the capital cost, would that money be better served if I were to channel into my existing business? Would the rate of return beat what I'm going to face from the banking, going into the banking industry? And if we look typically, traditionally, where we look across around the world, and based on our analysis, typically a virtual bank takes easily 3 to 5 years to even break even in certain markets. So then the challenge is that, would you be able to fund a bank and sustain it for the next 3 to 5 years while you build a big customer base, monetize them and start showing profit as well? As I mentioned earlier, Kakao is one of the example where I think they have turned positive in less than 24 months. And I think that's one of the record around the world. But if you look at most of the digital bank in UK, for example, not many of them has turned positive yet, except for one, Atom Bank. And that's simply because, I mean, the way the business model has been is they've gone after a SME segment, which tends to be much more, I guess, profitable for them.
Mm. But this can be very disruptive to the traditional banks because of, you know, trying to get the, there's only so much of, you know, capital or consumers that you can capture, especially within, you know, the region itself. And thus, it will go on into a war. Where you would have, you know, some offering the better deals, giving promos. We've seen with, I guess, you know, with the ride hailings and, you know, the all kinds of gig economy players doing the same thing. And then sustainability is always that question mark. Can they do this in the long run? Yeah. Would this have the same effect on banking systems as well, where you have these players coming in and offering you, you know, really, you know, lucrative deals to get onto the platform, but then that sustainability comes.
So, Jeff, I look from a consumer perspective. I mean, this is good for consumer, right? I mean, competition is always good. I mean, you're going to get better rates for your FD savings account, deposit accounts. You're going to get better rates from your lending. I mean, with personal financing, auto financing, whatever that. Right? So from a consumer perspective, I guess this innovation, this competition is good because you're going to see a lot more innovative product coming into the market. You're going to see better rates. But from our experience where we looked at different markets, the initial period, we do think that there's going to be about a bit of price war happening because new entrants would want to acquire customers. So you're going to see players throwing better rates. I mean, for example, in Hong Kong, the first virtual bank has launched early this year and they've been giving 200 basis points higher than what the market has been offering traditionally. So then what has happened is that over a period of time in markets such as where the new entrants comes in, eventually it will reach an equilibrium where, you're not going to have that best period. But as an end user consumer, I think it's good for everybody to see competition. But for the traditional bank would be then is that how do you change in order to adapt to the challenge, new challenge coming in. And I think that's also another positive element we have seen in markets such as Korea, where when Kakao came on board, it set a wave of change within the traditional bank where they start improving their mobile channels, they start improving their web channels interface as well as call center as well. So overall, I think net for the overall industry from a customer experience perspective and also benefits to the customer, I think net is a win-win for the end user customer as well.
Are we ready for these virtual banks? Do you think the consumers here in Malaysia are responding well to?
I think so. Because, I mean, simply because if you look at Grab, you look at Uber, you look at Foodpanda, a lot of e-hailing, the number of e-wallets that have in the country and the usage that's happening. So I think, and what's the difference? A lot of this digital bank, virtual bank have done is that they've made it simple enough for users to use them. And I'll use Kakao Bank as a great example where when they launched, initially, they were targeting for millennials. They're saying that, look, our customer base is going to be 25 to 35. This is where we go. But 24 months after they have launched, what they realize is their fastest growing segment happens to be age group of 50 to 60 plus years old. And the reason behind that is that the people that traditionally you would think not as the traditional customer base of virtual bank, they are saying that it's so simple to use it. I didn't realize that, you know, you could do banking so easily. So I think that is what that's going to fundamentally change in terms of virtual bank. So I think from a readiness perspective, people are always ready. If you give a good product, people will always be able to embrace and use them as well.
What can these virtual banks offer? Basically, is like any kind of services that the banks would traditionally offer, even loans?
Yeah, so typically, I mean, a lot of markets where we see is that, I mean, the basic products would be CASA, current account, savings accounts. Then, of course, you got time deposit. And of course, then we see a lot of them offering around payments, as well credit cards and a lending product. And most of them start with some of the basic lending products such as personal lending, auto financing, and so on. And eventually, mortgages and everything. But that's a bit more complex. So we see a lot of them tend today to play around simple lending products as well as current account, savings account. Mm. There are also a few virtual banks that's targeting around robo-advisor, for example, investment, going after issuing micro insurance for customer segments as well. So it's almost similar to traditional banking. The only difference is that traditionally, the traditional banks tend to offer A to Z of the services. If you look at a retail bank, for example, in Malaysia, the A to Z of a product, you tend to be able to get with any of the large banks as well. But what differentiates between them and the virtual bank is virtual bank tends to have limited set of products. But what they do is they try to better in terms of customer experience, products and services as well.
Mm. And finally, Shankar, I guess, you know, for those who've been listening to this now would probably get excited with virtual banks, especially, you know, we stepped into this year and probably we'll see a few of them towards the year end of 2020. But what's at risk here in terms of, you know, trying to get them on board as quickly as they can? Because we've seen there's some changes that's happened in the EU in terms of, you know, banks opening up their APIs for third-party players to get into it. That happened about 2 years ago. And so, but, you know, until now, we've yet to really see some developments in that area. Here in Malaysia, Bank Negara Malaysia is taking a precautious step, even though it's a it's quite progressive if you look at it. But what's at risk in terms of just letting these kind of, you know, virtual banks operate as quickly as we can? Because there's a lot of benefits, but there's surely some cautious that we should
be at. So if you look at the risk overall, I mean, essentially what's going to happen is a worst case scenario is that you're going to have one or two, I mean, assuming out of the five, even with the high standard and high bar of criteria in terms of who you're going to select, some of them are going to come in with business models that initially on paper looks great, but then when you go out, the cost of customer acquisition becomes high, your business plan doesn't convert. Then what happens is that what happens next, right? Mm. So which is why part of the draft exposure Bank Negara has requested is an exit plan where they realize that, look, this is something new. I'm going to launch virtual bank, but I also want to know that in 5 years, if your business is not able to turn around, what are the trigger point that will cause your investors to pull out? And if that happens, what is your exit plan? So as part of the submission, what Bank Negara has asked is that there would be interested parties to clearly spell out what would the exit plan be. Is it selling off to a consortium, or is it somebody else taking over? Who is stepping in and so on? So that part of the plan has to be clear as well. And moving on to that, I think is the virtual bank trend is something that you need to do it, because like it or not, within the region, Singapore has done it. In fact, Philippines has launched virtual bank bank without the virtual bank licensing framework. They've used the existing bank. In fact, in today's even in today's banking guideline framework, regulation framework, the incumbent bank could launch a virtual bank in itself. So like it or not, this is a trend that's coming. And if you're going to be in forefront of the financial services sector, this is something that you need to embrace. The key thing is, how do you manage the risk, especially around, you know, if the business plan doesn't go according to plan? How do you manage the technology risk? How do you manage cybersecurity is also another area as well. And that's all clearly spelled out in the guideline today. And what Bank Negara will do is that they would supervise as they are supervising any regular banks as well. So that's for certain, right? You are still in a regulated environment. You will still be supervised as well.
Mm. And I guess we'll know more towards, you know, come the end of February, and it will be a continuing development story.
Yes, I think so.
All right, Shankar, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate that.
And that was Shankar Kanibaran, the Financial Services Advisory Partner for EY, talking to me about everything you need to get up to date with the virtual banks industry. If you miss any parts of the show, you can download the podcast now on bfm.my or the BFM app. My name is Jeff Sandhu, and this has been Tech Talk on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.